News Centre at 5. A man's been arrested under the Terrorism Act after a suspicious package was found on London Underground yesterday. A controlled explosion had to take place at North Greenwich Station. London Mayor Sadiq Khan has promised greater security on the Tube. The undercover reporter known as the Fake Sheikh has been jailed for 15 months for tampering with evidence in the collapsed drugs trial of singer Talisa. A judge told Mazia Mahmoud that his motivation was to enhance his reputation and that he wanted another scalp. Prosecutors are reviewing 25 other cases based on his work. They include former London's Burning actor John Alford, who was also caught up in one of Mahmoud's stings.
It's taken over 20 years for some of us, but finally a judge and a jury of our peers has woken up to Mazia Mahmoud's lies.
The Defence Secretary says a fleet of Russian ships passing through the English Channel will be marked every inch of the way. HMS Richmond and Duncan are following the flotilla of 8 vessels, which includes an aircraft carrier. There are reports that the European Union's lead negotiator in the talks with the UK about leaving wants discussions conducted in French rather than English. An EU spokeswoman says that's not an official line. The Prime Minister didn't want to get into it, preferring to stress the progress and cooperation during a Brussels summit in the last day.
We will conduct the negotiations in the way that is going to make sure that we get the right deal for the United Kingdom. I have played my full part, and other member states want the United Kingdom to continue to play our full part for as long as we're members of the European Union.
Prince Charles has visited Abervin exactly 50 years since the mining disaster there. 144 people, mostly children, died after a huge coal tip slid down a mountainside onto a school and houses. And despite being a cartoon character, Wonder Woman is being made a United Nations Honorary Ambassador for the Empowerment of Women and Girls. The superhero is being officially given the honour at an event attended by UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. That's the latest. I'm Charles.
BCFM 93.2.
Celebrating diversity, this is Bristol's BCFM 93.2.
It's Friday, folks, 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. We hope the home of everything the government doesn't want you to know. I'm Tony Gosling, and I just saw a little smile creep across the face of our guest this week. That's Conservative Councillor for Brislington East, Tony Carey. After the 6 o'clock news, Bristol's second oldest church at St Michael on the Mount at the bottom of St Michael's Hill has been in mothballs, unused by the diocese for the past 17 years. Last weekend, it was an inferno with priceless pews, medieval wooden carvings and other artefacts destroyed forever. On Facebook, somebody was pictured wearing a devil mask with the burning church in the background. So are the Church of England here good guardians of our city's heritage? Or are they more concerned, like property speculators, with cutting the best financial deal for their property? Also, the Investigatory Powers Bill looms, and the security services are found guilty this week of mass data trawling. GCHQ in Cheltenham, I hope you're listening. They've been doing it illegally for the last 17 years. And on the same week, The Intercept publishes its latest investigation into where all this surveillance software is coming from. And it asks, are the people that make the software also able to read everything the government is using it for? And Adam Curtis has got a new film out, Hyper-Normalisation. But as usual, the BBC don't dare to show it on the television. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 degrees Celsius, getting chillier and chillier, isn't it? And dry. This weekend, highs of 14 Celsius, sunny spells and windy on Sunday. Next week, that's highs of 16, showers on Monday, clearing for a week or so with plenty of sunny spells. Next weekend, 29th and 30th of October, Highs of 14, sunny spells. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news, it's Conservative Councillor for Brislington East, Tony Carey. Hi, Tony. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening. Well, pleasure to be here.
Now, this is your second chance, isn't it, at being a councillor?
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about how you got into politics in the first place and when you first became a city councillor.
Parting the mists of time, I retired from the Royal Navy back in 89 and working for a local coach operator when the people from Brislington East ganged up on me one evening, invited me to a meeting and asked if I would stand against what was then, in those days, an absentee councillor who was more interested in national politics than community politics. So I somewhat foolishly said yes. This was back in 1990, the good year of the poll tax. So not a lot of Tories got elected that year.
The riots.
Yeah, it was a good year for making news. The following year, we made a big dint in the Labour majority. And the year after that, 92, I managed to turn it over with a majority of a whole 147 votes, I think, something like that.
Royal Navy, what were you doing there?
I was one of Her Majesty's artisans. I was an apprenticed engineer, and I specialise in light alloy sheet metalwork, and so I worked on aircraft, airframes and engines.
Whatever happened to British engineering?
Now, you see, you blooming presenters, you always ask these questions. You know full well I'm going to cause nausea now, because
well,
dear old Maggie, love her or loathe her, Maggie Thatcher reshaped the whole of British industry in her period. And the government of the era decided that apprenticeships weren't the done thing. Engineering apprenticeships therefore fell by the wayside. The rest, you might say, would be history, but it was a wrong move, I believe, and as I believe a lot of Maggie's directions were wrong. But then I'm only me at the ground level, you know. I'm at the coalface of community politics, I think. I don't have any aspirations for going any further than working for my community.
So the idea of engineering, I mean, we did actually run a little piece on our dialect show and had a clip from here a few weeks ago. There was a chap called David Guinness. Now, he worked for Hawker Siddeley Dynamics. He was an electrical engineer, and he was designing missiles and things in the 1960s. There seemed to be a big brain drain to the US. A lot of people from Britain were taken out. But he came up with an interesting idea, which I thought was an interesting idea. It was like quite a lot of these things that have been engineered, things like over the years and designed like the internet, have actually ended up as being quite a threat to the ruling classes, to the rich and powerful. And he thought that this was one of the reasons why the engineers were out of favour. But the fact is, actually what they're doing, of course, is they're doing the design work that is leading to jobs, to manufacturing industry, that kind of thing. They're really, talked about the coalface, but engineers, what they're doing is they're putting together what we need in order to create jobs, factories, make things, sell them, and be successful as a nation.
When you consider, my era was the qualified in 71. The aircraft I was working on in those days still had honking great cables going everywhere. Control rods were big tubular affairs that went all the way down the full length of an airframe. Totally different set of circumstances now. It's all, I'm going to say, use the phrase, fly-by-wire. Totally different, and so different materials, of course. I mean, in my day, it was aluminium alloys. Steel was used sparingly because of the weight. But nowadays, of course, we're talking about carbon fibres, we're talking about titanium. And when titanium was introduced into the aircraft industry, Her Majesty's Admiralty looked at me in my era and said, we don't want to retrain you at your cost. Let's bring in a whole new era of young men and women, because that's one thing I didn't ever have to put up with, was having a woman I would say, as my boss. I did have a woman as my boss, but I didn't ever have to work alongside. In fact, I would go months without seeing a single female.
When you say put up with, that's a bit controversial, isn't it? I mean,
I think at the time, that to do the job that we used to do was a physical job, and we didn't think at the time that perhaps a lot of women necessarily had the physical ability to do our job. We've since learned otherwise, but at that time, I think that was our belief.
What about generally speaking? I mean, one of the stories we reported on a couple of weeks, a bit unfair in a way, me bouncing these on you, but it'd be interesting to see what you make of it, is one of the senior people in the Chiefs of Staff, recently retired chap, was saying, well, actually, if Russia was to attack Britain, well, there's nothing at all we could do because our armed forces are now so totally depleted. Now, I would suggest to you, today we have got the Russian Navy and an aircraft carrier, a little flotilla sailing down past the east of Britain, round the English Channel and out into the Atlantic round, and they're going into the Mediterranean to join their Russian friends in the east of the Mediterranean. But they're doing that, they could quite easily sail down the middle of the Atlantic if they wanted to, but they're not. They're coming right in our face and they're saying, well, look, do you really want to fight? And I wonder if what you make of the depleted state of Britain's armed forces now.
Well, my luck was, in 23 years service, no enemy bullets ever came my way. A few of the friendly ones flew over the top of my head, but my era was the Falkland sort of era, and we only just had enough resources in 82 to reclaim a poxy little island like that. Nothing. No, I'm not being disrespectful to the Falklanders, but the islands themselves are physically very small, and it was an affair that we really had to use a huge percentage of our resources to resolve. If the same were to happen today, I don't think we could do it. And as for the Russians coming past, they've made their point. Possibly not. This is why, perhaps, so much percentage is being put on Trident. Although I don't necessarily agree that that's the only option you should have. Because in 81, the then John Knott came on board HMS Fearless, which he had just signed off as to be scrapped. And I invited, I was Social Secretary of the Warrant Officers and Chief Petty Officers Mess at the time, and I asked the captain if we could have entertain the minister for lunch. And on the one condition that we didn't harangue him, of course we did, and I put it to him that the next war would be conventional, and he said, "Oh no," he said, "the next war would definitely be nuclear." And I thought, "Oh crikey, you know, here am I on HMS Fearless, definitely not a nuclear resource on it." And he's talking about the next nuclear war. Well, within 6 months, of course, the Falklands blew up, and it happened literally overnight. It wasn't a case of arguments. It wasn't a case
But
all of a sudden, the Argentines decided this is what we're going to do, and they went ahead and did it. So it caught us totally napping. And it proved the point that conventional warfare, there is still a need for conventional warfare. We're proving that in the Middle East every day. But I think also the Russians made a point today. They've sent down through the channel. They've done it before. They've been down the channel before. But they've sent down a huge armament to say, okay, yeah, the point you made then. And I think we have to sit back and take notice.
I mean, if it does come to a fight in Syria, who do you think would win?
Certainly not us. I mean, it is a frightening situation when you look beyond day to day. I'm loath to go there personally, but we wouldn't win. We would have to start firing off our big bombs quite early on in the game, I would suggest. Otherwise, we would have nobody left.
Interesting, though, isn't it, that, you know, a bunch of naval officers can sit around and, whatever you were saying, petty officers, I'm not quite sure how it all works, sit around with the Secretary of State for Defence, and he's wrong and they're right. A bit worrying, isn't it?
Well, I mean, the guys I was at dinner with that day, I mean, we had guys who would have been 25, 30 odd years experience. I was a, how old was I in those days? 82. I was about 33, 34. So I was probably at the peak of my engineering aspects, and I didn't get any higher in the military after that. But
was it something you said to the minister?
Maybe. No, I think that followed on afterwards. I had delusions of stupidity, but I managed to beat them out of myself.
Okay, so you're also very active in the local community in Bristlington. Just give us an idea of what sort of stuff's going on down there. Well, or up there, I should say.
Well, on the other side of the river, right, well, conservation-wise, Bristlington is well-blessed with lots of green spaces. We have one particular active community volunteer group called Friends of Bristlington Brook, and we have taken it upon ourselves over the last few years to clean up the areas of the brook generally, but particularly the Nightingale Valley and St Anne's Park. St Anne's Park Woods area of the Bristlington Brook.
Isn't that something the City Council should be doing, really? I mean, people are paying
this
a council
is a bit
tax,
of woodland
aren't they?
That, they somewhat neglected, and I think there are probably people in Bristlington better able to speak about the true history of this than I. But we decided that we would go down to the brook, clean out all the wheels, supermarket trolleys, bicycle frames, etc., and mountains and mountains of litter, which we did. We started that probably about 4 years ago, and that's we're on top of it now. So instead of having this sort of litter-strewn environment, natural environment, we now have a clean natural environment with walkways that are dry. People can take their dogs, their children through there. In fact, one of the great successes I think we've achieved over there is that schools now hold forest schools in the woods, which they didn't ever do before. They're there for them. Other aspects of Bristlington, well, people will be perhaps aware of the buffer of fields that run between what one might call Old Bristlington and the Bristlington Trading Estate. They are front line for development, and in fact we now know vague plans about what is going to happen there. What I'm trying to do in the immediate future is get together a group of people to represent Bristlington and Broomhill's needs, and so that when this development goes ahead, we ensure that it doesn't curtail our desires, our aims, but it also so that we get as much out of it as we can, and so that the developer gets as much out of it as they can, because if we work together, I think we can all come up with a good plan.
Other than that sort of thing, what do you find most of the calls to you are about? I mean, because actually, you remember, you've been a city councillor, haven't you? Housing, yeah?
Housing, probably, and harassment. That's probably the two big things. People at the moment don't seem, particularly since the Brexit vote, it would maybe, that people seem to have, some people seem to have taken it upon themselves to, I'm not saying be racial, just antisocial towards people of other races, perhaps. It's difficult to describe what is a racial comment. When Brexit first happened, it was alleged that white youth were going around saying to the Polish community in Bristol, "Well, you lot are on your way home soon then." And I think, well, that's just a plain stupid thing to say, because as we all know, anyone in Bristol's history knows, the Polish community have been contributing to Bristol's history since before the Second World War, for sure, you know, and ever since. And as this is what I love about Bristol. Excuse me, I'm just going to digress now. Bristol's multicultural build is responsible for what makes Bristol so attractive to people. The number of people who come to Bristol initially to work or to study and never go away because they like what they see. So this is what makes Bristol interesting. And if people out there think that a vote like Brexit is going to make a huge difference to how the real people of Bristol want to live and work, then they're mistaken. I'll let you.
We've had a big multicultural, multinational population in the city before we even entered the European Union, let alone there was free movement of labour around the EU.
I think that the only people who genuinely have anything to fear about movement of labour are those people too lazy enough to get up and move themselves.
You could be right. So let's have a look. Just actually, before we go and have a look, they've got the first story here, which is this Oyster card system that they're going to be bringing in, and smartphone payments on the buses, which is a bit of a bugbear of mine. What's the difference between when you were on the City Council back in the early 1990s, Avon as it was, and now? What have you noticed?
We got nice, shiny, newer vehicles now, but not a lot has changed. Not a great deal has changed.
Same old council officer faces, are there, some of them?
Funny you should say that, but yeah, maybe one or two of them are... I don't know how they've managed to survive the various culls we've had in Bristol, but there are one or two characters whose names ring
the bell. I talk about them as the permanent government, because they're sort of always there, no matter who we vote for. And maybe that's a good thing, that it's not easy for politicians to get rid of civil servants, because then you know, if they were to do that, then you'd probably end up with a whole new load of civil servants as soon as you got a new administration.
Obviously, a civil servant or the officers are tasked along the political lines of whomsoever is in power at the time. However, you can perhaps an officer can tweak their interpretation along to their own style. So maybe, let's say, for example, though people know me, I was elected as a Conservative councillor, but I do not toe the Conservative line religiously at all. In fact, I'm possibly their loose cannon, and not to be feared, but just keep an eye on. And perhaps something similar happens with an officer, because it's up to us politicians. And I used to call ourselves amateur politicians, but of course we do get an allowance now, which makes a difference. And I think we have to justify our earnings, and our earnings are. Our remit now, beg your pardon, is to question more vigorously, to be a little bit more adventurous in how we question our officers, so that when we turn round to the likes of you and to our electorate, we can say, we are doing this because, not we are doing this because that man said so, we are doing this because we want to do it that way. And I think transport is one of these things which should hopefully be shaken up. 20 years ago, I'm going to talk about transport quickly, if I can, we were selling off bus stops to an advertising agency who ran them quite well, but now we want to bring them all back into house. And so we then will control the advertising from that, and that could hopefully then be a revenue asset. The only snag is, doing so, you've got to replace all of their old 20-odd-year-old bus shelters. And this is, people all over the city are grumbling to me about this bus stop. It's taken 3 weeks to fix this bus stop, councillor. What are you going to do about it? Well, I am not going to do anything at all, because the point about it is a move forward. 20 years ago, we thought that plan was good. Here we are now, 2016, we think, well, that wasn't such a clever plan, because now we're going to do it this way. And times do change, thoughts do change. One thing that doesn't change sometimes, as you say, is perhaps the guy who's advising us as the best possible.
I wonder if it's the same person advising you about the bus stops who advised you all that time ago to prioritise them. It's now saying, oh, we need to bring these back in-house. The other thing, of course, is if you're allowing some company to put bus shelters on the public land, wouldn't it be a good idea to say, well, you've only got that for the next 15 years or something, to give them a limited lease on when they got it, and then all of a sudden their bus shelter comes back to you and it's all yours. But anyway, let's have a look at while we're on buses. Bristol is going to get its own Oyster card system for buses and trains, apparently. This is actually quite an old story. I didn't realise that, but maybe this isn't quite the one I was looking for. But I know this week they've announced that there's going to be some kind of smart payment system on the first buses, which is going to actually take something like from memory between 10% and 20% off of your fare if you're paying by phone. Now, that actually, what that really means is if you pay by cash, you're paying 10% to 20% more.
In that case, then, let's right, let's start at the beginning. I think the evolution of the ticket system is great. I used to drive for a company that sub for Megabus, and often people would turn up with something on their phone. Here you are, drives, that's my ticket. And I'm thinking, right, okay, away we go. The problem would be, of course, if their battery goes flat, which often did happen, because they can't show me their ticket then. Oyster cards, long overdue, I think. So people who want to travel should be able to, just by putting their card on a thing and a receiver, and off they go for however long. I'm also hoping that Bristol will see sense and allow something along that line for young people. Old people have a wonderful Oyster card, the old person, elderly, whatever it is, got bus pass, and I use mine a lot. Why don't young people have a similar facility, so that they can access the people of the youngsters of Brissington, Broomhill, Lawrence, Weston, Shirehampton, can come into Bristol for events without having to pay quite a significant bus fee. Also, one thing I'm hoping to see developed would be if somebody bought a ticket for Ashton Gate or the Memorial Ground, that ticket could also be used on the buses, so they don't have to bring their car into the city centre. If they could take their car to a suitable park and ride and go into the city centre area just on the ticket that they've got for, let's say, you know, Ashton Gate and in the up-and-coming arena. That would be a classic case. It's happened in Southampton. It must have been nearly 30 years ago that if you bought a ticket for St Mary's, you also then got a free bus ticket, and off you went to your football match by bus rather than use your car. So I think that's something we perhaps haven't looked at properly, and perhaps something we ought to.
Okay, it's around about 15% these fares are going up if you use cash. Sounds yes. Like we're going down the same route as London, where you can turn up with a pound coin, £2, £3 coins, but you can't get on the bus unless you've got some sort of little digital thing. Now, this really irritates me, because you've got effectively the banksters, that's what I call them, the people who ran away with nearly £1 trillion of our money from the government in 2008 because they were so bad at managing their banks. They're now effectively dictating things through people like First Bus. They're saying, well, you've got to have one of these little chip and pin things, you've got to have a smartphone app, but cash isn't any good anymore. And this agenda towards a cashless society, no one's really being asked if they want to get rid of cash, but we're being told, well, if you're going to pay by cash, you're going to have to pay more. Well, I would say, actually, no, I will pay whatever and I'll pay it in cash, and if you don't like it, you can lump it First Bus.
Interesting point of view. I hadn't thought of that. I hadn't thought of it. I like the concept of Oyster cards, because, as you say, you go to London now and you can't get on a bus without some sort of prepaid...
But there is a wider agenda, is what I'm saying, I suppose, in places like Finland. It's been introduced, it's been kind of soft-sold to us through these magazines like The Economist, where, actually, well, let's go over to a cashless society. Actually, for centuries, people have fought to have a cash society, because cash is actually worth something. Maybe a note isn't, but, you know, even your coin is worth something. It's a metal that's worth something, whereas in the even go back to ancient Egypt, they used to use these systems of credit where someone is telling you, oh, you've got this amount of credit and that amount of credit, and historically there's been a battle over whether you can have something that's worth something physically in your hand and decide what to do with it, or whether someone somewhere in a distant computer room is going to tell you, well, you have and you haven't. And what happens when it goes wrong? That's the other thing. You're stuck, are you stranded?
Well, We've seen that more than a few times.
Well, so you say your battery runs out just as you're about to show this thing to the driver.
Yeah.
Anyway, First Bus, I think, you know, you should be taken to Trading Standards or somebody like that. So if someone's got the money to get on the bus, then who are you to say they shouldn't? I just... Yeah. Okay, I'll get off my soapbox now. But you've actually done driving, coach driving and that sort of thing. So, yeah. I mean, you think maybe this is a move forward?
Well,
you think it's quicker, I suppose.
If you had a busload of 53 passengers all going up to London, like the Megabus used to be, 53 or thereabouts, much more than that now, probably near 100, I would guess, on their new vehicles, and they're all paying you cash, you're a right target for a robbery
on
the way.
Well, that as well, but also, of course, they've got rid of conductors, haven't they? So this is sacking people that's in the process. The old conductor used to be, they're doing the same on the trains, trying to get rid of guards on trains. Listen, folks, we need these jobs. You can't just say, oh, only one person can be on a train, or maybe you're going to tell us, oh, a train is going to be automatic, you're not going to have a single person on it, and it's going to drive from point A to point B, controlled by a computer. What happens to the thing if halfway along the route? I just find it frustrating that a lot of this technology is to do with just demanning. So you've got kind of a robot world where human beings are just extracted from
it. I can't see the logic in getting rid of the guard on a train. I just don't see
that. It's called the money. They don't want to pay them.
Well,
Tony.
Yeah, but the driver is in a compartment. He can't even see what's happening in his train. And we all know that, unfortunately, there are some people out in our world who are incapable of travelling on a train without causing nausea to other passengers. So I think that I'm probably with you on that. I can see why they're doing it. Yeah, it makes sense if you're the bottom line man or the end columnist, but it's not a good idea. Getting rid of conductors in the old days, yeah, but basically what it means, and we all know what happens now, a bus can be at a stop 5 minutes or more. Well, it just loads someone, and someone comes on and says, I need to get to so-and-so, where can you take me to that I can get the
next? I mean, back in the days when things were sensible, that person could have had a conversation with the conductor,
exactly,
and not delayed
yeah.
the bus. Anyway, so a driver has got to do everything, apparently. The cashless society is something I'm not at all in favour of. I mean, you've got we're getting towards the human microchip, aren't we? You've got microchipping dogs. We're being encouraged to do that in barking, believe it or not. If anyone wants to look that up on the internet in London, everybody's supposed to be getting dog chips in barking, otherwise they can be fined or something. And with a little chip and pin on your debit card or your credit card, this is the next stage to this, is microchipping human beings. They're already doing it in places like Switzerland on the ski slopes. You've got to have a chip. Actually, they put it maybe round your neck or whatever, but some people have now got these implanted in them.
I've accessed my computer now and my phone and my iPad by my fingerprint.
Right.
And I think...
Not your iris scan, though.
Not yet.
that one's
technology
coming.
Technology hasn't reached this far. But, yeah, that in itself is perhaps a sign of the times.
Well, the main problem, of course, with all of this electronic money is someone in a little computer somewhere far away can either hack or just switch you off and you're completely stranded. Anyway, back to the news. And this week we've had a Bristol Rich List 2016 revealed in the Bristol Post. Who is worth the most money this year? Well, for a start, we've had Kevin Carhill, who used to work for the Sunday Times Rich List, on this show quite a bit over the years, and he's made it absolutely clear people who are very, very rich are very good at making sure they don't appear at the top of the rich list. But let's see who's here. Number one, Sir James Dyson at £4.5 billion. Eddie and Sol Zaki at £3 billion. Commercial Property Investment Group. Well, those are the people who are speculating on all those empty commercial buildings that you can see around the city,
yeah.
No doubt.
No, don't wind me up on that one.
And Peter Hargreaves, CBE, he's worth £2.1 billion. We reported on this show a while ago that he was interviewed three times by the Scotland Yard as a suspect for fraud back in, I think, the 1980s or 1990s. Actually, we had the chap on here who interviewed him, the police officer himself. And he was being accused at the time of using clients' money to speculate for himself. That's Peter Hargreaves. Chris Dawson, £1.7 billion he's worth. He's 64 years old and owns a successful home and garden discount chain, The Range. Stephen Lansdowne is the partner in crime, if you can call them that, with Peter Hargreaves, with Hargreaves Lansdowne, the big firm, £1.4 billion, owns Bristol City Football Club, and of course he's a tax exile. Then you've got got Sir Cameron McIntosh, and this is theatre, 9 London theatres he owns. He's worth $1.1 billion. Christine Ong and family, worth $1 billion. They have a stake in the Chilcompton-based luxury goods manufacturer Mulberry. J.K. Rowling, OBE, she's worth £600 million, apparently. One of the globally successful authors, of course. Sir David McMurtry, £600 million he's worth. He's an engineer. Hooray, an engineer! Commissioned the building of the first futuristic Swinhay House in North Nibley, Gloucestershire. And he's a big landowner, too. Also down to number 10 is Andrew Nisbet and family, £450 million he's worth. Catering equipment is the source of Bristol-based Andrew Nisbet and his family's wealth. So that's the first 10 in the list. But I will put a list, a link to this up on our show page, which is www.thisweek.org.uk. So you can have a good look and see if you can recognise anybody who's on that list. Maybe someone you didn't realise was quite so wealthy. We've got the Marquess of Bath down at 17. Who else do I recognise on here? Actually, not that many more of these people. So there's obviously interesting to see who the real rich are. But anyway, are they the powerful? That's the other question. Are the rich people actually the powerful people? What do you make of this list this week, Tony?
Well, I've met a few of them. And mind you, so with everyone else, I suppose. But let's go to the top of the list. Sir James Dyson took his production out of the UK, or a certain percentage of his production out of the UK, because he wasn't allowed to develop a site where he wanted to. So the local authority said, no, you're not going to build that. Okay, you're employing 700, 800, 1,000, or however many local people, but we don't think where you want to build your factory is right. So they, and he said, right, and off he disappeared abroad, wherever.
Fair play to him. Fair play to him. I mean, surely we should be facilitating building places so that, or maybe even allowing him to convert places so people are going to have jobs. I don't quite know why.
No, he should have come to Brissington, though. Come to Brissington. We've got plenty of spare space, or we had. I was up in Brissington Trading Estate this week looking at spare spaces, and I found one factory that wasn't being properly utilised and a couple of small warehouses. Every other site on our on our trading estate was active, and I'm well impressed at that, because that's employing people. And then along came good old George. I can't talk about him too badly, because I didn't realise at the time quite what a disaster he was for the city in many ways. He's imposed these double yellows and parking restrictions and speed limits, so that the people coming from Bath, one particular firm I'm thinking of, employs 30 people, most of whom come from Bath because they relocated to Brissington. Now with the new parking restrictions, they've got nowhere to park when they actually get into work in the morning. So I'm hopefully...
I'll tell you what, I could possibly rent you one of those little machines that scrubs out the lines on the road. How about that? A knockdown price.
Yeah, well, I only want to borrow it for about a weekend, all right?
Yep.
Well, Saturday and Sunday, I'll get a discount for a Saturday and a Sunday.
You certainly do, and we'll have a chat after the programme on that one. Anyway, you're the puppet. Trump once again refuses to condemn Vladimir Putin, but says Russia's president is not his best friend, as each candidate accuses the other of being a puppet. Well, this is the farce they call democracy over in America. I wonder what you make of these two candidates, Tony. Sum up Hillary Clinton, how you would sum up Donald Trump?
I'm going to let a little bit out of the bag. I would class myself socially as a folk singer. And I have a Facebook friend in America. I've never met him, but he's from, I'll call it the Deep South. I haven't got a clue, actually. But he plays bluegrass banjo. And he is a Trump supporter. And I said, how can you possibly support a buffoon like that? Basically, and he replied, because he's the better option to us. We don't have your system. We don't have multiple candidates. We have an option of him or her.
Well, hang on, isn't it the same here? I mean, at the last election, it was either Ed Miliband or David Cameron. I mean, those were the only people who really were in the running to be Prime Minister.
You're right, they were the only ones sensibly, but wouldn't it be nice if people had had the strength of their convictions to have said, well, I actually find don't like my candidate for whatever party, not because I don't like them as a person. I don't like the party policies. And I think this is what is being missed out on a lot of this. I haven't got a clue. If Hillary Clinton gets into power tomorrow, I have no idea what she's wanting to do. I have no idea what Mr. Trump wants to do, except employ lots of brick builders to go and build this wall he's going to have done. You know, I have no idea. I would guess both candidates will retain a nuclear deterrent. I would guess both candidates would like to think that they will do more for the poor and disenfranchised than the other one would do. But there's no idea what they really have in their manifestos. They've certainly not made it on.
Well, I mean, it seems to be mostly on personality. One of the things that really bothers me about Hillary Clinton is her record in Libya, which, if you read Seymour Hersh, she was a great investigative journalist, probably the greatest in America. He was the one that, back in the Vietnam War, he exposed the My Lai massacre of the American troops over in Vietnam, for example. And more recently, he still has some very good contacts within the US military, people that will talk to him because they know he'll get the story out through the London Review of Books or the New York Review of Books or whatever. And it was him who pointed the finger at Hillary Clinton as being behind smuggling Libyan nerve gas, that sarin. This is serious weapons of mass destruction, folks, through Libya into Syria in an attempt 2 summers ago to fit up the Syrian regime, government of Assad, with some nerve gas attack. Now, I can remember seeing these things on our TV screens, on Channel 4 News, BBC, ITV, everywhere, pictures of dying children, and that nerve gas is pretty nasty stuff, smuggled over from Libya. So when that all started to come out, so all of a sudden, crash, bang, what, there's a explosion and a bomb attack and a whole bunch of people, no one really knows who they were, attacked the Benghazi embassy and the ambassador's killed. So it looks to me as if Hillary Clinton is quite a serious war criminal, smuggling sarin gas and then blowing up her own embassy to cover her tracks. So she's got a bit of a track record with the establishment. Things aren't going to change, definitely, if Hillary Clinton gets in. But I suppose you're right about Donald Trump being a buffoon. Maybe that's better than a war criminal.
Well, I mean, they had Ronald Reagan. I mean, he was a cowboy of the First Order. It worries me whoever wins.
And there has been some exposés this week, actually, and I'll just play a clip from it now. It's about a minute and a half, and this has not been reported in the mainstream press at all, but there's a little investigative journalism outfit over in the United States. Not quite sure what they're called, but they've been putting these YouTube films up where they're doing secret recordings, hidden filming, etc., within the Hillary Clinton Democratic National Committee and various organisations which are arm's length from that. And what they've been able to show is that there is quite serious election rigging attempts going on, with Hillary Clinton campaigners and the Democratic National Committee inciting violence in Trump rallies. And here's a little clip from that now. It's pretty shocking to hear the sorts of things that they're prepared to do to try and sink the Trump campaign from the Clinton side.
This guy is Aaron Black. He works full-time for Cramer at Democracy Partners. He directs the spontaneous protests at Trump and Pence events. His real name is actually Aaron Minter. We don't know why he uses the name Black.
Nobody's really supposed to know about me. So the Chicago protest, when they shut all that was us. It was more him than me, but none of this is supposed to come back to us. Because we want it coming from people. We don't want it to come from the party. So if we do a protest and it's DNC protest, it's right away the press is going to say partisan. But if I'm in there coordinating with all the groups on the ground and sort of playing field general, but they're the ones talking to the cameras, then it's actually people. But if we send out press advisories with DNC on them and Clinton campaign, it doesn't have the same effect.
We have to be really careful because what we don't need is for it to show up on CNN that the DNC paid for X people to... That's not going to happen.
Zulema Rodriguez and Aaron Black are bragging about a protest last March that turned extremely violent and led the Trump campaign to cancel a huge rally. Fights broke out between protesters and Trump supporters, and two Chicago police officers were injured. The event was not spontaneous.
So that's just a clip from this, and if you want to look it up online, I'll put a link on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later on this evening. But it's called Rigging the Election Video 1. There's actually a new one out just yesterday, I think, called Rigging the Election Video 2, which is looking at busing people from one state to another state to do fraudulent votes. And that is also, this is all organised around the Democratic National Committee and the Hillary Clinton campaign. But once you start moving into the idea of using agent provocateurs, that is sending somebody in to cause violence on an opponent's rally, that's, you know, this isn't really democracy, is it, Tony?
I've just had a mental image flash across my mind of a Conservative Party meeting in 1990. And we could hear this shouting outside, and it was the woman who I was hoping to de-seat, and her friends came along and basically gave us their thoughts of our campaign. But no, you're right. I would love to see politics, clean politics. I would like to see policies argued so that if you don't get elected, you know that it's either your ability to hold an argument that has failed you, or people don't like your policies. I think people are scared to vote against a certain candidate because they're frightened that they might somehow or other people might know. I mean, I can remember the reaction when people learned that I voted for Brexit. People, you blimmin' what? You know, I mean, there is this worry that people aren't voting because they're afraid of what other people might think.
It's a different style of being, isn't it? When you're living in a country where everyone's got to agree on something. It almost sounds a bit Soviet, you know. Why not have differences of opinion? That's what this world is all about. You can have a difference of opinion and respect the fact that someone's got a different opinion.
You and I, certainly, if we were to hoist our political colours up, I suppose mine would be somewhat blue, and yours would be whatever colour you would support. But, I mean, the good point is that we should, you and I, and as it happens in Bridgerton East, my brother councillor is a Labour supporter, but we do get on very well and we work together because we know that between the two of us, we represent the vast majority of our electorate. Not everyone, we can't possibly represent everyone, but what we can do is make sure that the vast majority's voices are heard and we can then debate about what's happening. This is what isn't happening very much in politics now.
Well,
it's
that's
who
right.
shouts loudest.
Westminster and Washington, please listen to what's going on.
Yeah,
Bristlington,
yeah.
Listen and learn. Talking of Westminster, this week, Prime Minister's questions, one of the subjects that came up was the National Health Service. What's happening to it? A good friend of mine was actually taken, just literally this time last week, found out that she had stage 4 cancer. She was turned away 3 times from accident and emergency. They told her she'd got indigestion. She's now been given only days to live. So thank you very much, Jeremy Hunt, for making such a mess of this National Health Service, this beautiful thing they created after the Second World War. So that was what was being discussed this week down at Westminster on Prime Minister's Questions between the Leader of the Opposition, Jeremy Corbyn, and Prime Minister Theresa May.
We all want local government and the NHS to work closely together. But the problem is that local government funding has been cut. 400,000 fewer people are receiving publicly funded social care as a result of that. The NHS is having difficulty coping with the crisis they're in. Therefore, there is, unfortunately, bed blocking where acute patients cannot leave because there's no social care available for them somewhere down the line. The issue is the funding crisis in the NHS and in local government. The published figures by the NHS Trust show that the total deficit is £2.45 billion, but the chief executive says this figure may even be bigger. The government disguises the extent of the crisis through temporary bailouts, and next month the...
You don't like it. No,
Well, they are bailing out trust in a crisis. That, of course, is a good thing. But why are they in a crisis in the first place? Next month, Mr. Speaker, sustainability and transformation plans are going to be published. Many all over the country are quite alarmed by this because of the threat to accident and emergency departments. Can the Prime Minister deal with this issue now by quite simply saying there will be no downgrades and no closures of A&E departments in this statement coming out next month?
I say to the Right Honourable Gentleman, over the course of this Parliament, the Government will be spending over £500 billion on the National Health Service. That is a record level of investment in our National Health Service. But there is a key difference between the way that he approaches this and the way that I approach it. We believe on this side of the House that at local level, people should be able to make decisions about the National Health Service. That decisions about the National Health Service should be led by clinicians. That it shouldn't be a top-down approach, which is typical of the Labour Party.
Now, it's Theresa May replying to Jeremy Corbyn's questions about the NHS, mentioned the figure of £2.45 billion. The National Health Service is now in deficit. Of course, that's climbing. We're just about going into winter, Tony. A lot of people pointing their fingers at the Conservatives, maybe not necessarily at you, but certainly at Westminster, and saying you're trying to kill the health service.
The health service, unfortunately, is possibly a victim of its own success. When it was conceived, We didn't have issues that we have now. Let me just, if you cast your mind back, how many years is it? 70 years? That sort of order. We had probably quite high childhood mortality rates through disease. And we were able to use the NHS to get on top of these diseases, to eradicate some of them, and certainly make ways of controlling the others. Unfortunately, perhaps we then overused, for example, antibiotics, which has led to the rise in resistant strains of bacteria. And now a simple bacterial infection costs a fortune. Also, I do think maybe we've got to look at how much the profits of some of these drug companies that are providing drugs for the NHS. I would get quite radical, I think, about that, and maybe even consider nationalising some of them, because it's ridiculous what some people are having to pay for drugs in one country that are infinitely or significantly cheaper, beg your pardon, in another country. But also, let's say, for example, you or I decide we don't like the shape of our face. Off we go to a plastic surgeon because we've saved up or we have the resources to pay to have our noses reshaped. Unfortunately, there's a bit of a muck-up and we catch an infection, and we have to then resort to NHS resources to solve that problem. And I think this is nothing. If you and I have enough money to go and have our noses reshaped, then we should have enough money to go and get it put right if something goes wrong. And I think this is another issue. The NHS is the backstop. The NHS is the wicket keeper who, it seems, to pick up all the tabs of all the people.
But the point is, Tony, is dropping the ball. We got people who just cannot be admitted to accident and emergency because the beds are being blocked because people can't leave.
This is unfortunately.
So you reckon the Conservatives aren't trying to kill the health service?
I'd like to see more funding for the health service, but I can't agree with you there. I'm going to have to differ with you on that one.
Okay. There is another big problem with politics right now, and that is the 31 accusations of electoral fraud back from 2015 May election last year, where election expenses don't look as if they've been properly sent in, and and there are 31 Conservative MPs that are being looked into by the police because it looks as if they have overspent and wrongly declared their expenses. Do you think those should be, if they're found to be incorrectly submitted, should those Conservative MPs be forced to refight for their seats? If they did, the Conservatives may well lose their majority.
Well, let's take away the word Conservative and put in the word Labour or Green or Liberal Democrat.
Yes, but they're Conservative. And they're all Conservative, the 31 MPs who have been looked into by the police.
I would say if you're going to change the colour, I would say yes. So I'd have to say yes for that as well, then, wouldn't I?
David Cameron's Witney seat, but a huge Lib Dem swing to the second, second rattles the party. Conservatives have held on to David Cameron's old parliamentary seat, but saw their majority slashed by 20,000 after a strong show from the Lib Dems. Down to only roughly 6,000 from 25,000. Now, you know, it would have been a bit embarrassing if Cameron had lost that one, but he was only given that seat, of course, because he was a Bullingdon Club boy, he was tipped for the top, and he wanted a safe seat. It doesn't look like it's much of a safe seat anymore.
Nowhere safe, though, is it? That isn't a surprise to me that happened. I think he has a charisma. I would suggest that's why he had the charisma. That's why he was leader, perhaps. I was not a fan of Mr. Cameron. I'm more of a fan of Mrs. May, as long as she continues the way she's going. She's made some sort of fairly strong, bordering on radical statements, and if she can stick to these statements, I'd like to see her succeed.
Back to another running sore, if you don't mind, which is the child sexual abuse inquiry, the historical abuse inquiry. Absolutely terrible. But anyway, that was brought up at PMQs as well this week.
Lisa Nandy.
Needs to regain the trust of survivors. In September, the Home Secretary said she had no information about serious leadership failings, but on Monday she told the House that she had known about serious problems since July. Yesterday it emerged that senior Home Office officials were briefed as early as April of this year. She set up the inquiry, she appointed the chair. She was the individual responsible for the inquiry's success. She was the Home Secretary in April, and she was the only person who had the power to act. So can she now finally tell us when she personally learnt of the serious problems developing in this inquiry and why it was that she took no action at all?
Yeah. Prime Minister!
Can I say, I recognise that the Honourable Lady has taken a particular interest in this issue, and I'm sure she will recognise, as I hope other members of this House do, why it was that I set up the inquiry. For too long, people who had been subjected to child... For too long, people who'd been subjected to child sexual abuse had their voices went unheard, and they felt they weren't getting justice. That's why it's very important that the inquiry is able to continue and find that justice for them. I have to say to the Honourable Lady that one of the important aspects of this is that over the years, too many people have had concerns that people in positions of power have intervened to stop them from getting justice. There were stories around about the inquiry and about individuals related to the inquiry, but the Home Secretary cannot intervene on the basis of suspicion, rumour or hearsay.
So that's the Prime Minister speaking earlier this week about the child sex inquiry, Tony.
Right. If you hear rumours like that, you have to do something positive about it. You must investigate, and I think maybe she's at fault here.
Okay, yes. Well, it does seem like Theresa May's inquiry. Time now for the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock. Thanks to our guests, Conservative Councillor for Brislington East, Tony Carey.